This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, October 20th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. There are no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/veraicona100. She is the author of numerous books, all of which are must-haves. You must read her writings. You can get those at amazon.com. Some of them are no longer available. Is that correct?
Yeah. But those ones have largely been either reissued as updated, expanded editions, or they're incorporated into other books. So Hitler's Most Significant Speech, for example, is out of print in the original edition with the, you know, personal testimonials, etc. But it's the actual speech is still available in Hitler and Himmler Uncensored.
Great.
So the speech isn't unavailable.
Great. All righty. So you have some interesting things to talk about, as usual, today. And so let's go ahead and get started. Tell us what you're going to tell us.
Okay, the first thing is this Daily Mail article that was located by my colleague and posted, which I then checked out and weighed in on. Now, if one goes to the Daily Mail, and you can check this out right now, it's an article by Paul Harris. It was originally published on October 17th, 2012, updated 2 times on the 18th. And again on October 19th, 2012. And what they did is they changed the title completely and altered the first few paragraphs. They changed it to Haunting Smile of Girl Facing the Holocaust. So what they did is they made it darker than it originally was, because unfortunately the original article for the Holocausters was a little too pro-NS and honest. And it's literally just look up Haunting Smile of Girl Facing the Holocaust. It should come up.
And she looked quite happy. I mean,
she
certainly didn't look like she was concerned about her existence. And very interesting.
Right. Now, that was not the first picture, though, in the original article. The original title was, let me find it here. I have a post on this, by the way. It's Hitler's personal photographer captured Jutsi life in NS-occupied Polziland. So that's on the VIP site, and there's a screenshot of one of the updates, at least on the 18th. But it's right here. First, my colleague points out, wait a minute, this was updated. So it says updated 7:05 Eastern Time. October 18th, updated 1956 Eastern Time, October 18th. And then I put, wait, it was updated again at 1:41 Eastern Time on October 19th. The first few paragraphs originally read, "The old man looks relaxed, almost happy chatting to the soldiers. He and most of the other Jewish citizens pictured here in 1939 and 1940 are smiling, seemingly pleased to pose for photographer Hugo Jaeger." This was Hitler's personal photographer. Another one was Heinrich Hoffmann. "And then yet we know 70 years later that these people and thousands of others like them were in fact prisoners to be despised as rats and parasites in Nazi propaganda." And then even more surprising, Jaeger was Hitler's personal photographer, blah, blah, blah. So now it reads, the first few paragraphs, "She has such natural beauty, she could pass for a movie star. She smiles, her demeanor relaxed. In normal times, this young woman would surely have enjoyed a bright and happy future, perhaps with a husband, children, grandchildren. But soon after this photograph was taken, she would face almost certain death." Now, almost certain is an oxymoron. You can't be almost certain, first of all. And then the haunting image, it's not a haunting image at all, but is one of a series depicting Jews in Nazi-occupied Poland before they were rounded up to be sent in the gas chambers. What a change from the original.
Indeed.
And instead of the older Jewish gentleman with a Star of David talking casually to the German soldiers there, you know, with a totally amiable look on his face, etc., they've got her smiling there, and saying that she went straight to the gas chamber afterward. Now, the original title, which I found on, I found it cached on Rare View, who they had posted the original one. And there was also, who is this other thing? Atlas Shrugs. Pamela Geller has the original article cached on her site. So the original title was Hitler's Photographer Captured the Plight of the Jews in Rare Color Album from the Kutno Ghetto. Now it's Haunting Smile of Girl Facing the Holocaust. Isn't that interesting? And here's the other thing they added, how Hitler's personal, in caps, photographer captured for history the plight of the Jews in Nazi-occupied Poland. So Kutno Ghetto is completely erased from the title. Just be aware that they make these changes because the line must appear a certain way, the narrative.
Right. So it must have been the editor that said, hey, wait, you've got to do something with this.
Yeah. Paul Harris got in trouble.
Yeah.
More than likely. Wait a minute. This is a little too pro-NS here. This is a little too honest, in other words. And then there's just one other thing. The individual, I'm not going to name him, who you had put me in contact with. Now, he sent me a CBS 60 Minutes Holocaust expose, if you will, on the 17 million documented for the Badrosen archive.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is if we take out the 8 million voluntary laborers who Hans Jürgen Witsch researched, we're left with really 9 million people who, you know, had a paper trail. For any number of reasons, and that would be the 17 million. The Germans were merely keeping track of all these persons for a wide variety of reasons. The video suggests that all 17 million were persecuted by the regime because they had a paper record and all basically died. That's not at all the case, but they want you to think that. Now, what was interesting to me is the gentleman at the end of clip one. And I will send you this clip that you can put on the webpage if you want to go along with today's talk, because people should watch it. You see this elderly Jewish victim, quote unquote, who survived, and they tell him that, you know, you survived by a miracle. That wasn't the case at all. They just didn't send the younger children and teenagers to the labor camps in the East, where there was going to be some hard labor performed. So they were excluded from those deportations. That's all the line through their names means. But when he describes the situation where some people were heaved into the urine trough at Buchenwald and left there to die, you can tell he's telling the truth. You can see it and hear it in his voice. But what is so important for people to understand and to read is Mark Weber's essay on Buchenwald, Legend and Reality. I have all the commentary and analysis attached to his essay on the site about Buchenwald. The communist underground and the Bloc leaders were overwhelmingly the perpetrators of these sorts of crimes, and they did happen. But the SS guards, who were severely understaffed at this time, when it was brought to their attention or when they witnessed it, those were the people who were hanged and killed in the concentration camps. It wasn't innocent Jewish internees and others. They were criminals who were abusing other inmates in these camps and had their own little system within the NS camp system. And they kept in touch with the communist outside. So this is so important that people understand how powerful this communist organization was in Buchenwald.
Oh, my. And that's something you never hear about.
Exactly. And the original document of the Allied intelligence officer that looked into this, I'll send you that, too. It's available as a PDF, and one can read it straight from Allied intelligence. Even he described these particular prisoners and the communists as Untermenschen. He said, these are animals. And unfortunately, as in any society or any prison, unfortunately, those people are there. We
Absolutely.
Have to deal with them.
Yes. And you know, they're in our prisons here in this country.
Exactly. And I mean, if we take this instance where this quote unquote Holocaust survivor witnessed this atrocity, compare it to the little 8-year-old boy who recently died, who was burned alive by a sex offender, people. It happens all the time. Kate, these people are just there. They're a societal nightmare. And the Germans describe these kinds of people as asocials. Those were the people who perpetrated most of these abuses in the camps. And unfortunately, because a big brother wasn't always looking over everybody, you know, the SS was extremely short-staffed. This kind of stuff happened. Those kind of creeps did those kind of things in the camps, but not quite that severe. Right. That was really just, I can't even read that kind of stuff. But you know, it happens all the time, every day. We have murders all the time, especially in democracies. So we need to just keep that in mind. But it's important that people see that clip and watch that survivor, because you watch him and then you watch Cisblatt, night and day.
Oh, yes.
Truth teller versus liar. You can see it and hear it in the voice and the face. So that's very important.
Okay.
And then with that, I guess we can go on to this Stolzfus thesis, resistance of the heart.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're familiar with this at all.
No.
Okay. Basically, what happened is the German wives of Jewish men, for the most part, there were some other instances too where it was a German man, or yeah, a German man and a Jewish wife, but that was quite in the minority. They protested literally on the Gestapo's doorstep, as Stolzfus puts it, for the release of their Jewish spouses. The Gestapo relented and did it. And even 2 weeks later, after this protest, which Hitler, Himmler, and Goebbels all went, we better not go there. Let's just release these people and forget it. 2 weeks later, a whole slew of them was released from Auschwitz and sent back home. So this right here proves that, yes, Germans could openly protest effectively, that the Gestapo wasn't this terror organization that would kill, you know, if anyone raised their head against the quote-unquote regime. And that, you know, Hitler could be influenced. Now, this runs contrary to what we are usually told, that it was a terror police state. That just isn't the case. And along the way, Stolzfus refers heavily to Robert Gallatoli's a description of the Gestapo, and really the Gestapo was so understaffed and there was so much for them to do, so much on their plate, if you will, that they relied almost solely on citizen denunciation and collaboration to even get anything done, especially in the way of enforcement of racial policy, which was really aimed at removing the Jews. Just pressuring them to the point that they would be socially rejected, ostracized, and then want to leave. And those who refused, and as the war progressed, couldn't get out, would be interned and deported in due time.
Right. And Germany wasn't the only country that was practicing this kind of thing. When you look at Poland in the late 1930s, there was a lot of persecution. Actual persecution and boycotting of Jewish businesses and things in Poland. So I think that there were other countries, not just Poland, but Hungary and other countries who were really looking to get rid of the Jewish element in their society.
Right, exactly. And what's interesting is a lot of the personal stories, the eyewitness testimonies and stories of many of the people Stolzfus spoke to, and he himself is a Jutsi, their stories reinforce the stereotypes we have of Jutsis. And basically what they say is, well, you know, Rudy, his father didn't want Rudy to marry me because I was just a clothes rack. I didn't have a dowry. I didn't have money to give to the Jutsi family business. So, you know, this one Jewish father didn't want his son Rudy to marry her. She was a quote-unquote German clothes rack is how he described it. So the discrimination went both ways, and we must understand that. And many of the stories also reinforce that idea that the Jutsis will only convert and assimilate to advance their own kind of commercial niche and interests. So what they're really doing is they're converting to Catholicism and marrying the German woman to advance their own social status and their business acceptance and position. So, you know, when that's the case, and these their spouses who love them dearly are saying the same thing, one has to kind of step back and go, gee, this is why the NS ideology resonated amongst the majority of Germans. And it did. And Stolzfus can't get around that. And so basically what this book is a condemnation of all Germans. But in my view, it should make sense, because we're seeing that these Jutsis really were an aggressive kind of parasitic element, and that they confirm it themselves with their own testimonials, and that the Germans felt disadvantaged by these people and therefore wanted to exclude them. And so, you know, German civilians were extremely supportive of National Socialism, and Hitler and Goebbels especially wanted to avoid any kind of coercion. Hitler did not support terror. This is in Mein Kampf and elsewhere. He said, if we cannot win the broadest spectrum of people, we are not going to be able to rule. You know, we'll be kicked out. It won't work.
Right.
And so Goebbels' job was to use propaganda, imagery, etc., news, all these things that Jutsis used to win people to their worldview, to win Germans to the National Socialist worldview. But the very important thing that Stolzfus concedes is that when it didn't work, the NSDAP backed off in favor of these minorities, so that, okay, don't push so hard, let it happen. So they let the intermarriages continue. They really tried to ostracize and pressure through that propaganda and getting everybody on the same page with the anti-Jewish measures. But when people adamantly didn't go for it, like these intermarried couples, the NSDAP backed off.
Right.
Now, would Stalin have done that?
No.
No. And did Churchill back off the black shirts? No, he mass arrested them, made their meetings illegal. I mean, we've got to understand that each government saw certain elements as a serious threat to their legitimacy and their power, and that they did resonate amongst a large mass of their people. If that had not been the case, then they would not have taken these repressive measures against them. NS Germany was no different. It was just the German style of doing things,
right,
which is a little more thorough and bureaucratic.
Right. And that's the way that Germans are. They're very efficient, and that's a good thing.
Exactly. Right. And he just goes on to point out that it was at least 110,000 to possibly 700,000 of these mixed race German Jews living in Germany. That's a tremendous number. And I mean, one can see how the NSDAP kind of had to take its racial theory and go, okay, we oppose race mixing. We're trying to get the Jewish influence out of our country, but at the same time, we have this massive problem of as many as 700,000 of these mixed race people. What to do, what to do. So we see that the NSDAP had to make exceptions, had to make concessions, couldn't quite hold that racial line as rigidly as they would have liked to. And see, this is where we have to hear a theoretical version versus the real world version.
Right.
The real world version is what Stolzfus gives you, though in a biased way.
Right.
Just keep in mind he's a Jutsi.
It is very interesting, and it shows how the Jews assimilated in the German culture to have that many mixed marriages because, well, Frankfurt was the first city-state that actually gave them freedoms and emancipated them. And they were pretty comfortable in Germany, which is indicative of all of these marriages. Because
exactly.
Usually they are very isolated. They really, are in the ghettos, and they stay that way. So
Right.
they were feeling pretty comfortable, which implies that they did have a good deal of freedom and success.
Right. I mean, the NSDAP had to kind of back down off of this and at least offer them, a chance to make a living. And that is basically what Brian Rigg writes about. And Stoltzfus just comes at it from more civilian perspective, that the intermarriages kind of protected many of these mixed race and Jewish peoples. But again, if we hold this line that NS Germany was the most quote unquote lethally racist regime in human history, that does not hold. That is nonsense. And when a state makes concessions and backs away and does tolerate, practicality or realities that are against its ideology, it is not totalitarian. It is backing off.
Right.
When it refuses to use terror and instead wants to rely on persuasion, that is not a police state and a terror state. Now, see, this is what bothers me so much when people say that America today is fascist or
Oh,
totalitarian.
that
It
drives me nuts.
isn't, or my website and your radio show would not be on. We wouldn't even be allowed to speak.
Right.
People have got to understand that actually, democracy and the idea of letting off some steam and letting people have some freedoms to dissent actually reinforces the power of the government and keeps it in power longer than if the government didn't allow any free speech at all. Every government knows this, and Stoltzfus brings it out and says that, the NS Germans, like anybody else, the NS regime, he uses that phrase, knew that it worked to their advantage to allow people to let off some steam, to criticize the government, to criticize Hitler. He let jokes be told and stuff like that. It's just an absolute lie that that didn't happen and that people were killed for telling a joke. That's just
Yeah.
nonsense. Even in Russia, even in Soviet Russia, the regime wanted people to tell jokes. They wanted some stories of dissent to keep the potential overthrowers at bay. And this is a very important psychological principle that governments understand much better than most people.
Right.
So democracy is really founded on that idea. They pretend like they're giving you a choice between candidates. They pretend like they're giving you the power to choose from amongst propositions that they select or decline to put on the ballot. You know what I'm saying? So, and
Sure.
it's the same thing, free press. People can let off some steam and go, hey, at least I can criticize my government. But is that not really reinforcing the power of the government and the fact that they're
Sure.
never going to be overthrown or
But
have a
they let us do
revolution?
this. They let us do this.
Exactly. They want you to be able to do this because then they don't have to worry about a revolutionary core building up.
Sure.
So, Hitler was just as savvy, and it's in Mein Kampf. He even told the German people he thought this exact thing.
Sure.
So he didn't even hide it from you. And that's what's so great about it. He was very honest. As we've said before, Goebbels and Hitler were both incredibly honest with people and just basically tried to tell them the truth. And they weren't hiding these psychological principles from most people. And of course, Goebbels is the one that kind of told Hitler, it's a really unagreeable scene, that protest there. We can't have this going on right now. We don't want social disunity or unrest in a time of war. Gee, that's what happened during World War I. And we see where that got Germany. So, of course, Hitler backs off. Now, Stoltzfus takes this above and beyond. And as I stated in my talk on the Rosenstrasse protests that people can listen to, he predicts the future and says, see, they only conceded to keep social unity and to prevent unrest during the war, but Hitler would have deported these people and killed them eventually in the genocide. No, Stoltzfus, you can't say would have. That's projecting into the future. Now, readers just have to keep in mind that when an author uses the term would, they don't have proof. they are speculating into the future based on what they think. It's an assumption, not a fact. So he uses that a lot. He takes what he thinks Hitler would have done and just goes ahead and assigns something to him.
Right. Now, I've got this audio file linked to today's program. And
okay.
It's like 50 minutes long. And it's very good, I think. Of course it's very good.
Thank you. Yeah,
I like your interjections.
Yeah. Well, I try to make it interesting because when someone just reads, it's a little boring.
Exactly.
But you got at least the first part, you know, the first part of the introduction and Walter LeCure's very revealing introduction, if I might say so myself.
Yes.
They concede quite a bit and go, gee, how do we explain this? The
right.
Gestapo backed down. Women, children, and elderly actually told the NS leadership where to go. And these Jutsis were released. And even protected in some cases. So how do we explain this in, with our current narrative of Hitler, the totalitarian madman dictator?
Yeah.
And also, it severely undermines the Holocaust tale, you know, in the general sense. If Hitler was so bent on European Jewry's destruction, why would he let mixed-race Jews of all Jews live? Those are the most dangerous of all because they, quote unquote, poison the blood of the Germans, right? As
right.
we're told in much NS propaganda. They should have been the first ones to go. And even Schultz says this and goes, how do I explain this?
Right.
It's really just an interesting book.
Yeah.
Everybody should buy a used copy. Just get it cheap. It's not a great read, but just get a nice cheap used copy or a Kindle edition and read it. Very revealing.
Okay.
And you'll also learn a lot about psychology and how the historian controls the narrative. Schultzfuss does a great job managing the narrative and holding the Holocaust line while trying to explain this severe anomaly that challenges it. So, and I mean, we have so many other anomalies. This is just one among a growing number of problems for the Holocaust narrative. So just important. And, you know, again, he asks this, who were the Germans married to Jews and why did they openly disobey one of history's most ruthless regimes? I mean, shouldn't we obviously discard that ruthless regime thing since this did happen? Do we still need to hold that line? I mean, he wants readers to turn off their minds as they're reading and just kind of let the information flow in
right.
without critically assessing it. So that's that. And as far as Goebbels talking about how it's very difficult what they're doing to the Jews and yada, 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 he's not referring to the Holocaust, the genocide and gassing. He's talking about rounding up Jews, breaking families apart, separating intermarried people. That's what he's referring to in his diaries. That's, you know, kind of a horrible solution and a final solution to this Jewish problem. And these actions being taken against Jews are pretty tough. And, you know, people don't need to exaggerate and make this burning, gassing thing as part of the narrative when ripping people apart and deporting people, using them for labor, sometimes against their will, is enough to stir up some resentment. I mean, we don't need the additional nonsense. Just tell the truth. You know, it was a horrible situation. World War II was not pretty, and it wasn't pretty in any country. And a point that Friedrich Berg has made that's very important, and I totally agree with, is that had the U.S. and Britain been bombed as badly as Germany and actually been a theater of warfare, we would have a totally different view of things, and so many more people would have died here. And there would have been much more brutality in Britain and America.
Right.
It would have been like the Civil War, where brothers were fighting brothers, families were ripped apart. You know, it's so far back in our historical memory, we don't really consider it anymore. But this is really what was happening in Germany. So we need to keep that in mind. World War in Europe, we were just almost completely untouched by it and jumped into this hideous situation of our own accord. when it had nothing to do with Americans. And of course, Britzies had nothing to do with European warfare. And what should have been a territorial dispute between the Germans and the Poles turned into this massive nightmare for all these people that was totally unnecessary. So instead of blaming Germans and Hitler, why don't we blame the human species for, you know, the atrocities and whatnot that did happen?
Or
the
that's
people really who's to blame.
Yes, exactly. Roosevelt and Churchill certainly were getting this war up, and that's the whole purpose for them provoking Japan to attack.
Exactly.
It's all provoked.
Right. So, I mean, the fact that Jutsis ended up in concentration camps, a lot of people use that. Well, you know, why did Hitler have to deport them there in the first place? That right there was a crime. Number one, they declared war on the man the second he gets in office. And number two, they were still trying to stir up problems. There was a communist underground operating all throughout Europe and Germany with many, many Jews overrepresented in the communist underground and amongst the resistance groups and amongst the partisans fighting for the Soviets. And Stalin made a point of never incorporating partisans as official soldiers or recognizing them in any official way so that they can maintain the illusion that these were true guerrillas fighting
right.
their own accord. No, they were Soviet divisions armed by Stalin and fighting for the Soviets against all the quote-unquote fascists. So another thing to keep in mind. There's a key question here that he asks, how are we to understand the decision of Joseph Goebbels, which is to back off and relent to these protesters, the NS Party authority for Greater Berlin to relent to unarmed street protesters, and Hitler's concurrence with this decision? That's a good question. And I basically put, maybe historians have exaggerated the so-called Nazi hell.
Yes.
It really exists. Gee, is that so hard to conceive of? Basically, 1,700 to 2,000 full Jews were released in the end, at the end of all this. And then, of course, he asks why these mixed-race Jutsis, who should have been really the number one threat to NS race creed, would have been saved. Why were they the majority that survived? They were 98% of the surviving German Jewish population at the end of the war. So if we really believe what Hitler himself said about mixed race marriages and race mixing in the genetic sense and the NS racial line that it was rigidly held, then why did this happen? That's something that they just can't explain unless we accept that the National Socialists were not as hardline as we've been told they were, that they understood that there was a difference between theory and goals and reality, and that they achieved what they could given the reality of the situation.
Right.
So, and it's very important that people also understand that this story is really told through eyewitness testimony. So once again, Stolzfuss's almost entire case is told through eyewitnesses or court documents he found. You know, the NS says one thing, and that was interesting that he found that, and it's in his very end where he talks about his methodology and the flaws associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
He basically concedes that the National Socialists and Gestapo and police people, so they were different organizations involved, SD, secret police, etc. They say one story. Their narratives are totally this, and the eyewitnesses are the exact opposite, very sensational, very detailed. So how does one go about deciding what is true and what isn't? We can't be 100% true. I mean, you know, we can't get 100% truth from that situation when you have each side basically accusing the other of the exact opposite. So, you know, that's up to historians and readers to kind of hash out and go, gee, what sounds realistic? What sounds legitimate? And that's what we've got to do. And of course, Stolzfuss runs with the official line that the Holocaust was going on and that this was somehow an exception. What?
Oh, that is amazing.
Why would they have one exception? That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Right.
And in 1943,
Right. Now, he wrote this book in 2001.
And he started his research in, oh man, way back in like 85 or slightly sooner, but couldn't get the documentation. And because of East Germany, they very carefully controlled any kind of documentary evidence that came out of their archives. Gee, I wonder why, you communist East Germans. that was when it was communist East Germany, and they just can't have the truth leaking out.
Sure.
Had to wait until that regime fell. And then, of course, he got some evidence, but still didn't find what he really wanted to find, and suspected that the East Germans destroyed those files. And I'm sure that those files would have exonerated the NSDAP. I'm sure it would have exonerated the Gestapo and basically affirmed that they were indeed telling the truth in these post-war trials about the Rosenstrasse protest, among other things. But when the communists destroy evidence, what do? Now you're left with a huge missing hole in your story. So,
Exactly.
Schutzfuss does the best job he can, but of course, it certainly isn't perfect. But what's so interesting, though, and what we really need to think about is that this intermarriage thing, it was such a tiny minority of Germans who even did that. It would have been so easy to just, quash them out and kill them or marginalize them to the point of non-existence. Why didn't that happen? Why buckle to such a teeny tiny minority?
Yes.
A
Uh-oh.
great question.
Yeah. What was it? 2000.
2000. So that's amazing. Of course, Schultzfuss tries to say it was strictly to keep the home front from collapsing.
Oh, that.
Only with that one teeny tiny protest that hardly anyone even knew about or knows about today, even. No one, I mean, when he went to interview these people, they hadn't even heard of it. They're like, what are you talking about? What protest? Okay, and I'm sure that Goebbels, he didn't report on domestic strife and protest or any sort of unrest, even in foreign countries. He kept that out of the press during the war because that was a potential threat to harmony and the morale. So I think we can rest assured very few people knew this was going on. It was pretty much limited to Berlin, and those who heard about it by word of mouth and saw it. And which Schultzfuss could hardly locate anyone who had even witnessed this when he started his research. Why would the regime be so afraid of one teeny tiny isolated little protest that hardly anyone knew about? That was going to make the whole German war effort collapse. That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, it shows the exact opposite of what people have been led to believe about Germany and about that time period, that they would tolerate and allow these 2,000 people to protest. I mean, and these were non-Jewish partners, 2,000 people.
Exactly. So why would you buckle to such a small minority? If you're, I mean, we all know that Hitler had an incredible level of support all the way pretty much until the end of that war. Kershaw wrote about this, the Britzi, and he's a Hitler basher.
Oh,
Like,
he is.
he rants and raves. So rest assured that if he couldn't find any evidence contradicting that Hitler was so popular and so supported even unto the very end, this doesn't make sense. It seems more likely that the vast majority of Germans would have supported quashing such unrest and saying, protesters, you keep quiet. How dare you protest in a time of war? So I'm not buying it. Schultzfuss has got a problem here that he really can't explain. What else? Really and truly, what the NSDAP was trying to do was pressure Jews out of Germany. Now, of course, this is supported by the private conversations he had with Otto Wagner early on, where he says, we can't harm a hair on the Jew's head. We can't expropriate their holdings, etc., etc. We must pressure them to leave through squeezing, a process of kind of ostracizing them, isolating them to get them to want to leave because life here is unbearable. There's no genocide talk and all this nonsense. And this whole, the whole pressure that came down on these intermarried Germans and Jews is reminiscent of that very thing. So this is actual evidence in the real world that supports what Hitler said in private. There's no talk of genocide ever. And Stolzfus leads you to believe that these people were being deported to their certain death. No, they would have been deported to do some labor during the war and that eventually would have been expulsed from Europe to whatever location the Germans decided on as a Jewish homeland, which Hitler had his eyes on Russia. As the whole Madagascar plan fell apart and his land in Western Russia started opening up due to the war itself, he said, that's where the Jewish homeland is going to be. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me I can't park the Jews in a marshy part of Russia. He basically says that in the table talk. So he's not talking about extermination at all.
Right. Or he would have done it. I mean, he just simply would have done it and certainly wouldn't have kept them in camps, wouldn't have tattooed them, wouldn't have given them food to eat. And, you know, it's just...
Right, right. And that's another thing. These Jews, these Jewish men and their women, the 2,000, they were given rations. They had their food ration cards. They had jobs, homes. You know, it's just this... What are people talking about? There wasn't a single Jew in Germany once the Holocaust started. They were all headed for certain death. That is nonsense. And as a matter of fact, in 1939, there were still a full 30,000 intermarried couples in the Reich and the Czech protectorate area. And in 1942, when the Holocaust is supposedly in full gear, the intermarried Jews was still 27,744. How do we explain this?
Mm-hmm.
We can't. We can't really. So it's just nonsensical. And of course, in September 1944, there were still 13,217 registered Jews in Germany, almost all of whom lived in intermarriages. And so how do we explain that in 1944 when supposedly all Jews were deported? There was nowhere to hide. One couldn't get away. The Gestapo was the all-seeing eye grabbing everyone and everything in their path. That it's just absolute nonsense.
Right. Especially when you look at the immigration figures from all of these countries. So many people immigrated in the early 1930s. And we were talking about the book, The Disillusion of Eastern European Jewry by Sanning. And when you look at those numbers... I mean, we're talking a lot of people left Europe and went to, well, to Palestine. A lot of them went to the United States. A lot of them went to England. And when we hear people talk about the Holocaust and they give out all of these numbers, they make it seem like, well, none of these Jews ever left. They did a lot. And they use, you know, they add those Jews. Well, how do I put this? They pretend like nobody ever left, that they were all there, and then they weren't there at the end of the war, when in fact, millions left before the war ever started.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Right. And then, of course, if you couple that with Friedrich Berg's evidence where he located that Sergio della Pergola report, that there were 1,092,000 Holocaust survivors in 2003...
Yeah.
If you just do a statistical analysis of average death figures from 45 to 2003, and you have that number in 2003, that he put that means between 5 and 6 million Jewsies survived the Holocaust. So there it is right there.
Right.
If you couple what Sanning found with that information, there you see clearly, you cannot deny that there was... A Holocaust. I mean, there was no Holocaust. You can't make the case when you put those two together. And then there's even other information, such as the official Red Cross report that put it at under 300,000 people total died of all races and nationalities, etc., in the camps. I don't know how people can't see it. It's because they see like that 60 Minutes clip with that old little Jewish man talking about how people were thrown into that trough at Buchenwald. That's what it is. It's the emotion.
Right.
It's the emotionally laden testimonies that keep people believing that there was a Holocaust, because how could somebody actually get on a screen and lie? How could they write a book that's a lie? How could they give testimony that was lies? And how could the Allies all lie together? But they did.
Exactly.
They did. It doesn't mean all of these Jewish people are lying. Some of them are telling the truth, such as the man in the 60 Minutes video, but they're not telling you the details of what actually happened. They don't give you the full story. They take it out of context or they omit. And then what they'll do is they'll base, like someone will base their memoir on what other Jews told them happened. That doesn't work. So you're basing your memoir of the gassings on rumors,
right,
that have become reality for you.
And
that's
some,
the problem.
Right. There were some initial first books, and most of the testimonies, most of the other writings are based on those first few books.
Exactly. And that's the problem. That is the problem. What's interesting is Stolzfus mentions a ban on Jewish emigration. Up until 1941 and the ban on Jewish emigration, I am unaware of any ban. That the NSDAP banned Jewish emigration?
I don't think they wouldn't allow them to leave?
I think that's absolute hoax. And yeah, that he has no footnote on that at all. So I put a big question there and said, what ban? You mean the Britzi ban that they wouldn't allow Jutsis into Palestine, which was under British protectorate?
Right. That's the only ban. Mm-hmm. And,
exactly.
And Roosevelt also would not allow them into the United States.
Right. So that could be the ban he's talking about. But what he's suggesting, the way he wrote that, is that the Germans banned Jews from leaving so that they couldn't leave and they were therefore stuck in this genocide process. And of course, he describes it as assembly line efficiency. Oh, brother, we're back to the assembly line.
Right.
Like they were on a conveyor belt going into a gas chamber. Unbelievable. Just unbelievable. Now, what's interesting too is the German leadership debated and discussed this intermarriage thing behind the scenes. So this was not something where Hitler goes, I'm against this, here's the decree. No, there was back and forth debate, discussion, which means some NS Germans were in favor of allowing this to happen. So they were okay with the race mixing to an extent. And others were adamantly opposed to it. And darn it, Hitler, why don't you just ban it altogether and sterilize them? Very important. The NSDAP was not completely united in its view of race mixing, of Jutsis and the treatment they received. There was always debate and discussion behind the scenes. And the same thing happened with Africans living in Germany. The NSDAP had conflicting views. Some NS Germans were okay with Africans and mulattoes, you know, living in the Reich and not being sterilized. That, you know, just let them live as they are. They're a small minority. Let them have a German wife or husband, whatever. And then there were others that were just freaked out about it and said, no way, this is a taint. So like any government or like any body of people, there was not 100% unity on all these issues.
Of course not.
And so many historians have presented it like it was this monolithic, all one brain kind of in the same direction. Not at all. And I'm sure that even in the Soviet countries, in these communist countries, there was some discussion behind the scenes. Hard to believe, but I'm sure there was.
Right.
And of course, these mixed couples lived openly together in marriage. They didn't try to hide it, most of them. So they were brazenly defying the NSDAP from the start. And some of them kind of flaunted it. So, you know, again, if Hitler is so adamant, then why didn't he just crush that teeny tiny little minority in a country of 60 plus million?
Right. And of course, we see movies about this, about the woman who, I can't remember, but I did see a movie about a German woman who had a Jewish husband. What was the name of that movie? I just can't remember it. And how she had to hide him. And I mean, this is a lot of Hollywood stuff that people believe. Based on Hollywood movies. I'm trying to find some of the first books. There was a book that Ilya Ehrenberg wrote about the Holocaust. I'm trying to find my notes about that book.
That might be on Amazon, because there's a book by him on Amazon. Is it the Black Book of Soviet Jewry or something?
I think it was, and or is. Yes.
Could be. Yeah. And I mean, yeah, a lot of this traces to Soviet propaganda and Soviet nonsense about fascism that just continues to this day, where they were all hiding. And there's a picture of Anne Frank with her family at the beach. Otto Frank had a business, for goodness sake. How could they be hiding in an attic and deathly afraid every moment when they're out at the beach? Is that not a little bit flaunting the situation? There's a very good post about Anne Frank on Scrapbook Page's blog. I believe Friedrich Berg has a link to that from NaziGassings.com. Uh-huh. People must check out, I think it's furtherglory.wordpress.com. Just type in Anne Frank when you go to that site. Excellent blog. He's just got one article after another taking a hit at different aspects of the Holocaust narrative. And he's very funny because he doesn't give you, he tries not to give any side, like, oh, were the Nazis really this evil? Or did the Jews lie? Or did the Jews tell the truth? He doesn't take a side. He lets you decide. Of course, a bunch of Jutsis have gotten on there and accused him of being a quote unquote Nazi, but very good blog. And he's got that post on Anne Frank that is quite revealing. So I would recommend people look into that. The whole hiding thing is just nonsense. And what's so interesting is by 1942, Goebbels is acknowledging that the problem of isolating these intermarried Jews and their Mischling children is an extremely delicate matter. Gosh, how do we do this when we really do believe this is a problem? This is a tough one. And the thing is Himmler says it was through intermarriage that Germans had developed feelings for Jews. That's true. He said this near the end of the war. He's like, see why this is a problem? See why we must be harsh? Because this is how this sympathy started in the first place, darn it. We've got to stop this intermarriage thing. So you see that Goebbels is going, well, you know, we got to be really careful. You know, maybe there is some Germanness to be salvaged there in these mixed race kids. And Himmler's going, I don't think so. This is how this started in the first place. Nip it in the bud. So again, that's contrasting views.
Right. Yeah, it is the Black Book, The Ruthless Murder of Jews by German Fascist Invaders Throughout the Temporarily Occupied Regions of the Soviet Union and in the Death Camps of Poland During the War 1941 to 1945, alternatively, The Black Book of the Holocaust. And they were going to publish this in October of 1944.
Yeah, how did they know? How did they know? In Ilya Ehrenberg, people, you look him up. He's a horrible human being. And if I'm not mistaken, a bit of a pervert and a sadist.
Mm-hmm. And he's the one that told...
Gypsy.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
He's the one that told the Soviet soldiers to rape as many women as they possibly could after they arrived in Germany.
Exactly. I mean, what kind of human being is this? Hitler never even made such an order, nor did Goebbels or any NS official about Soviet or Polish women. That was... In fact, that was severely punished.
Oh, immediately.
Said, you'll be hanged if you do that, SS men. Don't you even dare. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And Alfred de Zayas wrote about that in the Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau book he put out.
Right.
One can get that on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay. And then in what one should really read, Hitler's Theory of Power, in this, it's the first chapter in this book, because Basically, Stoltzfus concedes that the NS terror is overemphasized. It's actually way exaggerated. There were very few instances of real terror in the NS state. And really, the only instance of like a truly fully established story of torture was Elser. And Hitler said, you're going to get the confession out of him that he was sent by the Britzy Secret Service and that he put that bomb there to blow me up. And Himmler's like, I don't want to do this. I'm really not into torturing people.
Yeah, you've got to belong to the CIA to do that kind of stuff.
That's right. And Hitler said, you're going to do it. And I'll tell you what, people have got to read that. I'll try to find a book. I'm thinking it's possible that the Venlo incident could have something about that in there. I think it does. But Himmler had a personal aversion to torture and hurting others. So do we really believe that he was this monster that they say? It doesn't make any sense. And he says, Führer, we did everything. We pulled out every hat in our, you know, every trick in the hat. He would not confess. He would not. So whether or not they really could not establish that he was sent by the Secret Service or armed by them, but it certainly reeks of kind of Strasser-esque activity.
Yes.
So I think Elser was certainly helped by someone, but he was a pretty sharp guy, and he remade the bomb right there in front of the Gestapo. He said, all right, give me the stuff and I'll make the bomb right here for you and prove I did it on my own, of my own accord. And he made it there, and Himmler's like, wow, you know, what are we gonna do? So they had to kind of concede on that one. But let us just think, okay, this is the kind of mentality running the secret police, a man who's averse to torture. Unlike the sadistic, torture-loving Soviet NKVD officers, I mean, some of the people, many of the people, in fact, in the NKVD and even in our CIA enjoyed that kind of stuff. They really were sadistic.
Right.
And I mean, let's think about what kind of people we're putting in there versus who the Germans put in there. And yet we've painted the Germans as these absolute monsters.
And yet you never hear the stories about Germans putting petrol on some soldier, a Soviet soldier, and setting him on fire. And yet that's what they did to the German soldiers every chance they got, or to the German civilians.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yep. And here we have Stoltzfus talking about non-coerced mass support as the best means for achieving NS goals, admitted by the National Socialists themselves and personally attested to by Adolf Hitler. And of course, this is the reason why these women protested. It's because they did not expect to be terrorized.
Right.
They weren't demonstrating any kind of amazing bravery against a tyranny. They went, this Gestapo is overstepping its bounds, and I'm going to go tell it what I think. So NS Germany was more like the Anglo-Saxon order than the Soviet order, and we need to understand that. It was kind of an in-between, a third way that took from both, but we have definitely described it as something that it is not to this
right.
day. The terror and the coercion and all this nonsense is just not true.
Right.
And, you know, Hitler and Goebbels were into cultivating popularity through positive reception to the message. They wanted people to be enthused about this. And what's interesting is Gallatoli and Stoltzfus both argue that the citizens felt pride when they denounced fellow Germans who they felt were doing harm to the party idea or the German idea and what was being promoted now. They saw these Jutsis as an alien enemy, as a threat. And they openly and proudly helped the Gestapo identify and root out these Jutsis and communists and other, you know, political dissidents.
Given their history in Germany and what they had done in Germany, it's understandable.
Exactly. It's understandable. And the thing is if the regime wasn't doing it, and it was in fact the people, the public who overwhelmingly did this of its own accord, what does that tell us about the NS ideology and how much it resonated with normal people? See, that's what really scares the Jutsis, and that's why they promote chaos and diversity and multiculturalism in any given state, because they know that this can resonate again just as strongly in a very unified, ethnically singular state like Germany was. Right. They know that. And that's what they fear, I suspect. And there's just a couple other little tidbits in here that are very interesting. By mid-1943, we have Rosenberg saying that Baltic peoples must be wooed with good treatment and racial status approximating that of the Germans. Now, we have been told that Rosenberg was a fervent exterminator and hater of Slavs, just a monster. That's not coinciding with this evidence. It's just nonsense. It's just not true at all. He himself was a Baltic German. They called him the Balt. So he had insight into these other people, into this kind of the Slavic mentality. And of course, Goebbels, ruining the way the Wehrmacht had squandered its reception as liberator when it invaded in 1941, concluded that the regime had hit the Russians and especially the Ukrainians too hard, and that if they are treated right, something can be done with them. Hitler agreed to these assessments.
Hmm.
Do we really believe that there was an Ost plan to mass murder tens of millions of innocent Slavs? No. The Ost plan comes straight from von dem Bach Zelevsky, who said that at the IMT as a plea bargain for his life. And Carlos Porter has gone into that. He is the sole source for the Ost plan hoax.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. I mean, why would the German authorities themselves be saying such things about wooing Russians, etc., if they were going to exterminate them or if they were exterminating them? It's just nonsense. And of course, Goebbels says the Wehrmacht blew its chance with these people. It was too brutal, not the SS. Interesting, because the Wehrmacht said that the SS was too brutal and that if that nasty SS just hadn't come in there and ruined everything for them, they could have won over the Russians. So we see how the Wehrmacht blamed the SS for its own kind of incorrigible behavior there. That's kind of interesting, too. And that was, of course, a post-war narrative that was pushed by the Wehrmacht to keep itself, you know, cleansed of any quote-unquote guilt. So that's it. I mean, the SS became the alibi of the nation. Everything bad, either real or imagined, that happened during that war was pinned on the SS and the NSDAP. It's absolute nonsense.
It is. I was just reading some of the reviews of this book, and it is interesting. I mean, there are 11 customer reviews, and one of the fellows writes, a fascinating account of one of the most successful protests during the Nazi regime, spurred by the many couples who were intermarried Germans, one spouse Jewish, one not. When the Jewish partners in the marriage were taken away by the Germans, the remaining spouses reacted angrily, culminating in the Rosenstrasse protest of February 1943. This book is a very detailed and powerful look at the heart of a nation and its peoples. The author interviewed survivors and looked at literally thousands of Nazi records that had never before been examined. And he says, I found this book to be very inspiring and couldn't help wondering, what if more people had protested the injustices of Hitler's regime even earlier? Could the Holocaust actually have been prevented?
That comes straight from the book, actually. He just lifted that straight from Stolzfus, because Stolzfus asks that very question.
I mean,
now, this is, they did protest early on, though. The T4. That was publicly protested and stopped. And Stolzfus has to mention that too, the T4, Tiergartenstrasse 4, which was the euthanasia plan. So Nazi euthanasia divided families between victims and healthy Germans, causing protests that curtailed this program. It was eventually scrapped completely.
Right.
And the Catholics defied the NSDAP openly in 1936. So they basically what happened is Bormann, of his own accord, issued a decree to remove crucifixes from schools, and Catholic activists said, "No, you don't." And they told Hitler, and he said, "What are you doing, Bormann? I never ordered that." So Bormann had his own kind of little crusades that he did, and so many other NS officials did, and they just kind of, well, it's approved by assumption. See, Hitler would agree with me. And they kind of use that as their basis for issuing things. But when it came back to Hitler, or it was protested openly, guess what happened? This is not reminiscent of a terror tyranny regime. It just isn't.
Right.
And just one other thing I want to point out. Stoltzfus stretches a lot, and here's an example. He writes, "Successful propaganda turned persons into fanatics. For according to Hitler, strong beliefs made strong soldiers, and a person who believed a lie fanatically was stronger than someone who held to truth tepidly." Now notice Stoltzfus says lie. Holds to a lie fanatically, as though Hitler said that.
Mm-hmm.
But what did Hitler actually say? Here's the actual quote. "The future of the NS movement is conditioned by the fanaticism, even more the intolerance with which its adherents present it as the only right one," end quote. Where is lie in there?
Mm.
Okay, Stoltz
is
putting words into Hitler's mouth there.
Mm-hmm.
But his footnote betrays him. So, I mean, one can just go through these footnotes. It's incredible. He even talks about how Goebbels was opposed to political indoctrination. Wow, I thought Goebbels was Mr. Political Indoctrination.
Right.
Yeah, so basically what he concedes is that the public made concessions to the NS regime, and the NS regime made concessions to the public.
Right.
So they come to a middle ground. Gee, really?
And do we find that in America? Not.
I don't think so. And that's why we have so much tension now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. Our government isn't coming to any middle ground yet.
No.
So, yeah. Yeah. And there you go. That's really probably sufficient. Just real quickly, Rudy's father, the one that called little Elsa the German woman who married his son, the clothes rack, he was a Freemason.
I'll be darned.
So, I mean, as you go through their stories, you see that a lot of these quote-unquote stereotypes are actually true, observable truths about the Jutsis and their business savvy.
Right. And the name of the book is Resistance of the Heart, Intermarriage and the Rosenstrasse Protest in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And one can find that on Amazon.
Yes, and I would recommend it. And of course, when you read news stories, watch out for updated.
Right.
Just know that there's a certain line that they have to hold in the news story, especially on the Daily Mail and the Telegraph, which are Britzy.
Right.
And if it's not quite right, oh, that editor's just going to swoop in there and change that real quick.
And it's so obvious.
Yeah, I mean, especially when it's cached.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, goodness.
Right. So people can read that on our site. And, of course, you can go to Atlas Shrugs, too.
Right.
Website and see the original article.
Okay, and that is at VeraIconaPublishers.org. Now, people need to register.
Yeah, you need to register if you want to comment or use the search feature. For some reason, the search does not work unless you are registered and logged in. It'll just say it doesn't come up or whatever. That's just a WordPress thing.
Okay.
And if one wants to read the protected posts, then one has to have purchased a book from us at some point. It doesn't matter when.
Okay.
But those are for, that's for protected post access, which is different.
All righty. Very good. Well, I appreciate you being on the program today. Don't you just love the commercial-free programs?
I do. I like that. Keeps my train of thought going without any breaks.
Exactly. 3 minutes is a long time, and then you start doing other things during the break, and then right. You think, oh, what were we talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so. Exactly. I like it. It's wonderful. And thank you for having me, as always. I enjoy doing it so much.
Oh, well, we just enjoy your scholarship. It's wonderful. People love your things. It's
thank
wonderful.
You very much. And I appreciate their support. And just for the record, I know some people are trying to politicize the videos that I've put up.
Uh-huh.
And I understand that feelings are, you know, a lot of people are very... let's put racialized when they come to study NS, Germany or Hitler. They have like these racial ideas already. But the thing is we're trying to be as unbiased and simply presenting Hitler and National Socialism in a comparative way so that one can look at today, back then, Hitler compared to his contemporaries and Hitler versus today in a liberal, democratic, Masonic world that's supposed to be so wonderful and tolerant and peace-loving, etc., and see that, gee, NS Germany, A, wasn't so wrong about things, and B, wasn't so awful, was it? Trying to get people to just think about it differently from a perspective back then and from the perspective of today in retrospect. So we're not into discussion of which race is better than the other one. You know, none of that. It isn't political.
Right.
So if one wants to get into political debates about race or ideology, then one should go to channels that are dedicated to politics.
Right.
We're staying away from that because it's tendentious.
Right. All righty. So
that's all I wanted to say on that, though.
Thank you very, very much.
You are so welcome.
And we'll talk soon, right?
We shall.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.